It is my honor to introduce our moderator for today's panel. The Honorable Catherine Kimball Mizell is a United States District Judge for the Middle District of Florida. She was nominated in September 2020 by President Donald Trump and was confirmed by the Senate in November. Prior to her confirmation, Judge Mizell was in private practice at Jones Day, where she focused on complex civil and criminal litigation and appeals. Judge Mizell previously served at the Department of Justice as counsel to the Associate Attorney General, as a trial attorney in the Tax Division, and as a Special Assistant United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. Judge Mizell also serves as an adjunct professor of law at the University of Florida School of Law. Upon graduation from law school, Judge Mizell served as a law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas of the United States Supreme Court, Judge Gregory Katsas of the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, Chief Judge William Pryor of the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, and Judge James Moody, Jr. of the United States District Court for the Middle District of Florida. Judge Mizell earned her B.A. summa cum laude from Covenant College and her J.D. summa cum laude from the University of Florida. Ladies and gentlemen, Judge Mizell.
Thank you, Elliot. Very excited to be here, and we are thrilled to have a panel discussing the newest Supreme Court Justice, Amy Coney Barrett, arguably perhaps the most consequential jurist that President Trump nominated to the court. I'm just going to give a quick overview. We're going to touch upon her confirmation hearing first, then we're going to spend the majority of the panel discussing her potential impact on substantive areas of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. And then we'll wrap up with some discussion of her style as a jurist and leave some time at the end for questions. So I'd first like to introduce the esteemed panelists that are joining me here today. Immediately next to me is Mr. Christopher Mills, who is a constitutional law fellow at Beckett, as well as an adjunct professor of law at the Charleston School of Law. He served as a law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas during the October term 2018. We shared an office for a year, so I know Christopher quite well. He was previously a partner at Nelson Mullins and an associate at Winston Strawn, and also a law clerk to the Honorable David B. Sentell, who is on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Christopher received his law degree from Harvard Law School. Next, we have Dr. Vincent Philip Muniz, who is a Tocqueville Associate Professor of Political Science and also an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Notre Dame. He writes and teaches across the fields of constitutional law, American politics, and political philosophy, with a special focus on religious liberty and the American founding. His scholarship has been cited three times in the Supreme Court opinions, and most notably and recently for this panel in Espinoza v. Montana last term. Next, we have Mr. James Percival. He is Florida's Chief Deputy Solicitor General, and he oversees all of the state's civil appellate litigation on behalf of the Solicitor General. Mr. Percival previously worked at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he was counsel to Associate Attorney General Rachel Brand and senior counsel to Acting Associate Attorney General Jesse Panuccio. Before that, he was an attorney at Cleary Gottlieb, and he clerked for the Honorable Emmett Cox of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Mr. Percival holds a J.D. from the University of Virginia. And finally, we have Ms. Amy Swearer, who is a legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Her areas of scholarship include the Second Amendment, the proper role of the courts, and overcriminalization. She is a former co-host and now occasional guest host of SCOTUS 101, which is Heritage's podcast that follows all things related to our favorite branch of government, obviously the courts. Amy received her law degree from the University of Nebraska College of Law, so I'm very thankful that all of them have joined us today for this discussion. Okay, to kick it off, we all got to witness Justice Barrett and her amazing composure during her confirmation hearings. She clearly has a great command of the law and is able to navigate difficult situations. Professor Muniz, you know her personally, is my understanding. Can you give us a little bit more insight into who she is as a person?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me here. Sorry, just gonna take a sip of water here. So in my household, Justice Barrett is known as Emma's mother. Her oldest daughter babysits my kids. So it was funny during the hearings, we were watching them, of course, and my kids come in and they're very, very excited because they saw Emma in the background. the judge mentioned Justice Barrett's composure during the hearings. I suppose that comes because she has seven kids at home. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I teach a class at Notre Dame. It's called Human Excellence. This is, you know, undergraduate liberal arts class. And last year, one of the students, they have to write a paper on what makes an excellent life. And one of the students in the class wrote a paper, this was before the nomination, on what would it mean for a young college woman if Amy Barrett became Justice Barrett, and what that would mean for her. And it was really, truly extraordinary. And she focused on how she thought, and I think this is probably right, I don't know that a woman in U.S. history with such young children, she has six children at home, seven children in total. I mean, her oldest is a sophomore in college. That such a young woman with such young children has ever served in such a prominent role. And for this particular student of mine, but I think for young women and men in general, she is a trailblazer like unlike anyone we've ever seen. Certainly in United States history, and it's just amazing. So that she handled herself so well before the Senate, that she'll handle herself so well before the court is for those of us who know her. I mean, she's just she really does it all. She's so smart and so such a wonderful colleague and mother. I can't imagine a better person being on the court. We'll see how she is as a justice. I'm sure she'll be phenomenal. But she's just an extraordinary person. I mean, she's the type of person that makes you sort of feel bad about yourself. She does so much.
Thank you, Professor. You hit on a couple things, which, she is, I think, the first female jurist who has school-age children. She also is currently the only jurist who didn't go to an Ivy League school. But then on the other hand, there are things that are very traditional about her nomination. You know, she was a serving circuit court judge. She had an academic background. Those are not uncommon places for justices to be nominated from. Do others on the panel have a perspective of how her role will impact the public's perception maybe of the court or the view of conservative women in the law? Maybe Amy, do you have something you want to add?
Yeah, well, certainly I'd love to chime in as a conservative woman myself. I echo what the professor has said about Justice Barrett and what that means in terms of perceptions from the court. I think really what it is you're going to have now entire generations of young, budding, originalist women who will finally have sort of the originalist answer to the icon that was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. For so many of us coming up through law school, yes, there was a sense in which, having, whether it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Sandra Sotomayor on the court, yes, it was nice to see a reflection of Sandra Day O'Connor, my brain is, whoo. having women on the court in and of itself, I think was a good thing for us. But there was always that sense in which we felt left out of that joke because they didn't necessarily reflect our way of thinking about the law. You know, yes, there was a seat at the table for women, but was there a seat at the table for conservative women, for women who thought about the law the way that we did? And so to see her come up and to succeed at the highest levels as not just, a somewhat conservative, but as a true textualist, as a true originalist, as a true scholar of those theories of jurisprudence, I think is going to be so fundamental for generations coming forward. To see that and to see that it's not just, these theories of old white men. It's not just these theories of the Antonin Scalias, but that we see ourselves reflected up there. I think that is really going to be just socially, psychologically, a huge impact. I mean, and then to see it from someone who is so brilliant that she can stand up there and, become the meme of empty notepad. I don't think there's a way to overstate that, how big that is going to be for generations of women.
Yeah, in comparison, I have like 10 pages of notes for our whole panel, right? Well, one kind of final question for the confirmation hearing. It was a, I think, welcome reprieve that it, although highly publicized, was relatively congenial. Should we expect judicial confirmation hearings to continue on this more civil trend? Christopher or Jimmy, would y'all want to chime in on that question?
I'm happy to speak to that. Well, first of all, just thank you so much for having me. I was telling Judge Mizell before the panel, last year she got to introduce Justice Thomas, and I was manning the CLE table. So I think I got a promotion and she got a demotion, but I'm very happy to be up here with her. I think just for me, experiencing the confirmation process, prior to this process, I lived in DC, and for people who haven't kind of had that experience, basically any Hill staffer or any political appointee usually has a TV in their office, and that TV only gets news channels. And it is a totally normal thing to sit there all day working, watching every minute of the confirmation process. And that was my experience with previous processes. So it was actually very refreshing for me after moving to Florida to sort of experience it like a normal American, you know, watch the highlights on Tucker Carlson or whatever your sort of news source of choice is. But the thing that I really took away from it and what I think really contributed to the civility was I felt like, you know, I think sometimes we see Supreme Court justices and nominees as sort of celebrities, and there's this tendency to sort of not recognize the human side of someone like that. And I think whether intentionally or just because of who Justice Barrett is as a person, I think she was so humanized, for lack of a better word. We learned about her family. I felt like I learned about, you know, things she'd struggled with in her life, and I just felt like I really identified with her as a person. And I think once you do that, it becomes very difficult for the opposition party to attack a person. It doesn't land effectively. And I think everybody felt on all sides that it just wouldn't have come across well to attack Justice Barrett in that way. So I think that is a great thing and a lesson going forward, because I think hopefully everyone in this room agrees that this process should be about an exchange of ideas, and it is perfectly legitimate to attack people's ideas and say you think they're bad ideas. And so I hope that the takeaway from this, and maybe a good strategy going forward, is let's tell the American people a bit more about who the person is as a person, make it more difficult to attack them personally so that we can spend more time talking about their ideas. Now, just kind of my two cents about the issue.
I think Christopher and then Amy.
Yeah, and to chime in and to dovetail off of Jimmy a little bit, I mean, he's right. It was almost shockingly tame and amicable compared to the last 4 years of what we've seen with similar types of hearings. Part of that, I think, might have been due to, because of coronavirus restrictions, there wasn't an in-person audience. You weren't going to have the same, you know, shouting from the galleries that you may have had with the Kavanaugh hearings or things of that nature. But it really did come down to who she was as a person. And once it became clear that there wasn't really a route to attack her on who she was as a person, very few senators wanted to go toe-to-toe with her intellectually, and I think for good reason. It actually turned out to be an interesting set of hearings, just from sort of the tracks of questionings that senators did try to go with. I mean, in many respects, especially from sort of senators, Democratic senators, it became less about Amy Coney Barrett and more, how do we turn this into a referendum on anything but her? So you saw interesting attacks, pontificating about the election, pontificating about Donald Trump. You had some senators who, frankly, didn't even mention her. You know, they'd spend their 5-10 minutes and maybe mention her once at her own hearing. And so it was just this very interesting, you know, if we can't beat her, how do we ignore her? And I think on the other side, what Republicans did was very interesting too, in how some of them used the questioning process to actually almost teach civics 101 to Americans. Frankly, I think some of these sets of questions should count as CLEs or should be taught, you know, high school American civics and you know, how do courts work? Because you really saw her, that professorial nature come out. And so you'd some Republicans just walk through what are the role of the courts? What is originalism? What is textualism? That I think was very beneficial for those of us who did sit through all 12 hours on end and didn't just see the highlights. And that is something that I hope does continue as well, this really getting down to the nitty-gritty of the nominee's jurisprudential approach to things, because that is something that we saw come out very, very clearly.
I think the other interesting aspect of the Barrett confirmation is to go back and trace the development of the confirmation process for Supreme Court justices since Robert Bork, which really changed it all. You had Justice Scalia warn in the early 1990s in Planned Parenthood versus Casey that, if judges were going to be imposing their own moral values through their decisions, the confirmations would and should devolve into a series of, promises and pledges to senators. And so what you've seen, I think, is that happened, obviously, and then when the nominees became aware of what was going on and could start, giving very sort of broad answers and avoiding doing the things that Judge Bork did, you saw the senators start turning to more personal attacks. And so that was obviously the strategy during the Kavanaugh hearings. And so the response from the political branches is to nominate people who it's really hard to personally attack. And obviously Justice Barrett, has, from what everything has been said, is a sort of outstanding family, a very smart person. And so I think tracing the development of the confirmation process back, you've seen how much it has changed and how much it has become in some ways, and I think in some ways it's unfortunate. Senators asking not particularly relevant questions, like Amy was mm-hmm. talking about the election and the nominee having nothing really to say because it's not relevant to their job. And so I do think it's a little sad at the end of the day after watching them. You think, this seems like it could have been so much better. But I think it's sort of an inevitable consequence of the approach that the court has taken and the inevitable response of the political branches. One other comment in terms of going forward, it was wonderful to see that this hearing was relatively congenial, but we should note that the ranking member on the committee was heavily criticized for being congenial with the majority and has now been really ousted from her position on the Judiciary Committee. So, in terms of whether that continues, clearly there are significant portions of political influences that think it should not.
Judge?
Yes, Professor.
So I have one fear here, and I don't want to push back against the spirit of collegiality and being congenial. My fear is that conservatives in the Senate because they don't want to repeat the character assassinations that we've seen that the left does, that they will not fight vigorously against nominees who they think will misinterpret the Constitution. People shouldn't be gone after if their character is good, and that's what the left does. But there's a tendency, I think, on those on the right to say, well, these things need to be civil, therefore, President won, president should be able to appoint whoever he or she wants to the Supreme Court. Well, that's not the Senate's job. I mean, if you think someone's going to misinterpret the Constitution, you have a constitutional obligation to not vote to confirm that. And conservatives are too soft on these things. So there's a nomination in the next 4 years, and you believe the Constitution should be interpreted according to its original meaning. If you have a candidate that you think won't do that, you should fight like hell to keep that person off the bench. And I don't see that fight in the Republicans in the Senate. And I think that's a mistake. And they'll do it. They won't fight because, they want civility. That's not a winning, that's not their responsibility.
Okay, well, I think we're going to move into our first substantive area of the law where Justice Barrett might change the dynamic. So talking about the religion clauses of the First Amendment, Obviously, one of the most intensely followed cases of this term is Fulton v. City of Philadelphia. After oral argument, it is very clear that the court is unlikely to reach the question of whether Smith should be revisited. I think Justice Barrett, in fact, asked CSS's counsel why they were asking to overrule Smith, if they could win under Smith anyway. So that doesn't bode well for the court addressing the Smith framework. And in fact, I think Justice Barrett was in the per curiam opinion in Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn v. Como that applied the Smith framework and said that wasn't a neutral restriction on the houses of worship. So that's a long-winded windup for when the court actually has a case that squarely and necessarily requires it to confront Smith. Where will Justice Barrett come down on that as a self-proclaimed originalist? So I open that up.
Well, I'm happy to take a go at it. I mean, this is what I do, in my day job, and I have no idea where she stands on these things. I really don't. I wish I did. I think of all the dinner parties I was at with her when we could have talked about this and didn't. I really don't know, and I don't know. I mean, as probably everyone in this room knows, there are really good originalist arguments for overturning Smith and going back to Sherbert and reinstituting exemptions. Becca could tell you all of them. And there are really good originalist arguments on the other side. Some of the most distinguished constitutional historians, Philip Hamburger at Columbia, I've chipped in on that. So I actually think Smith is rightly decided as a constitutional matter. But if you're an originalist on the court, you could write a very persuasive originalist opinion either way. I just don't know. No justice on the court now has voted on Smith. I think there's good reasons to think there's at least four justices who would vote to overturn. But even that, this is what scholarly expertise gets you. I have no idea what will happen. I think Fulton will, the Catholic Church will win there, but Chris and I were talking right before the panel. I just reread the oral arguments coming down, and I just have no idea how the court's going to get to where it gets.
So I have just a couple observations from that oral argument. The first is Justice Barrett did ask that question, why should we overrule Smith in this case? But she also asked another question, which is if we overrule Smith, what do we replace it with? And I think, you're always trying to read the tea leaves, but the question is, was that a friendly question or a hostile question? I actually took it as a hostile question, kind of hinting that for all of the problems that people have with Smith, there may not be a better option out there. The second observation I would just make is, particularly to people in this room, obviously Justice Thomas is a hero for a lot of us. He's a big hero to me. But remember that Justice Thomas has staked out the view, at least as I understand it, and I'm sure Judge Mizell will correct me if I'm wrong about this, but as I understand it, he generally rejects tiers of scrutiny. So his view is that we ought not apply tiers of scrutiny. So if you go back and you read Smith, the principal debate in that case, as I understood it, was between Scalia, who said, we're going to have this general applicability rule, and otherwise citizens will become a law unto themselves because they can get an exception, under a variety of circumstances where the state has a very compelling interest. And you had Justice O'Connor not disagreeing with the results in that case, but concurring in the judgment, saying, no, the way we should do this is we should apply strict scrutiny. And that case was about Native Americans using peyote. And so Justice O'Connor said the state has a compelling interest in prohibiting peyote. So I think to people in this room who think that Justice Thomas is right about that, but also think that Smith be overruled, I would just challenge to think about how that would work. Because it seems to me that the entire idea behind getting rid of Smith is going back to strict scrutiny. And so, as a practitioner's note, if I were writing an amicus brief in a case where Smith was at issue and I was trying to pick up votes, I might write an amicus brief just to Justice Thomas pointing this out and just posing the question, how are we going to reconcile these two ideas? So I think maybe, I don't know what Justice Thomas thinks about this, but to me this is a hint that maybe he would not overrule mm-hmm. Smith, or at least would have to come up with something different than what the court was doing pre-Smith, because I think it can't be the case that every time the government substantially burdens religious exercise, the person gets an exemption 100% of the time. Now, I think maybe there are people in this room who hold that view, but I think if you think about that for a while, you realize that's just not going to work.
OK.
Can we hear a rebuttal from Beckett, maybe?
I'm sure we will.
Well, before getting into the strict scrutiny point, I think it's important to note that this is just a tremendously important area. Even going back to Obergefell, which said the majority opinion said that, you know, people of good faith, religious people, can have valid disagreements on that issue. The most recent decision, Bostock from Justice Gorsuch, made similar points that, you know, there are these important protections for religious people, and so this set of issues comes up in a bunch of cases, not just Fulton. You see similar issues in the Masterpiece cases and follow-up cases from that. How to preserve the rights of religious people to live their beliefs in a pluralistic society, and whether the answer to that is, you know, letting the government force them to subdue or, you know, stop living by their beliefs, or whether to allow them to live their beliefs and make the government have the necessary exceptions for that to happen. So that, you know, how the court approaches those questions, it obviously ruled in Masterpiece on a fairly narrow ground, to the dismay of a couple justices. But the court today looks very different, and it's apparent that that set of issues is not going away. Masterpiece didn't really resolve that set of issues. There's other cases raising the same exact issue as in Masterpiece, and there's cases like Fulton which raise related issues. So, you know, to the extent that Masterpiece was an effort, again, the court looked very different there. But if you know, the sort of Chief Justice approach of having narrow one-off decisions, you know, seems like these cases aren't going to be fixed by that approach. So in cases like Fulton and other free exercise cases, part of the question, I think, is how to apply Smith. So if you're in the Smith world, what does it mean for a law to be neutral and generally applicable? And we saw that issue come up in the COVID cases. The Diocese of Brooklyn case talked about how it wasn't neutral and generally applicable, but didn't flesh out entirely why the court reached that conclusion. And that's obviously a central issue in Fulton too. When the city of Philadelphia offers certain exemptions from its policy, but doesn't offer exemptions for religion, you know, does that mean that the law is not neutral and generally applicable, and so would fail even under Smith, which is basically the question that Justice Barrett was asking? So part of the question is fleshing out Smith, but part of the question is whether to retain Smith. And as a couple of folks have mentioned, I believe it was in a case involving a football coach praying out of the Ninth Circuit, Justice Alito, joined by several other justices, including Justice Thomas, described Smith as drastically cutting back on the protection of free exercise, which sounds fairly hostile to Smith. So, you know, respect to my friend Jimmy's comments, I don't think you have to call the alternative to Smith strict scrutiny. Obviously, in today's modern constitutional lingo, we like to sort of frame everything as a matter of scrutiny. But, you know, I think if you were Justice Thomas and looking at this, you could say that going back to a world like Sherbert, which I don't think used the language of strict scrutiny, at least that we would today, you know, that just because it requires balancing doesn't mean it's necessarily, you know, slotting things into a sort of arbitrary three-tier system of scrutiny. So, and I think that's the last important note, is that Justice Scalia famously had his article, "The Rule of Law as a Law of Rules." And I think Smith can be seen very much as coming from that idea, that we need to have this clear rule, because otherwise courts are going to have to do tough work of figuring out when a given practice substantially when a given policy substantially burdens religion, and you know, whether the government's interest is narrowly tailored and whether it's compelling. And if you read Smith, it really wasn't about the original public meaning of the free exercise clause. It's really about that idea that we need to have a clear rule. And so I think you see something similar in Justice Scalia's approach to Chevron, where instead of the courts having to figure out all these words, we're going to we're going to defer. And both of those cases are obviously under considerable criticism, Smith and Chevron. Justice Barrett, who clerked for Scalia, is, you know, surely well aware of you know, that idea, and that's an idea that's appealing to a lot of us, having clear rules and having that be a way that promotes the rule of law. But the question is how to deal with that in cases when maybe the clear rule isn't necessarily the one that would have aligned with what the original public meaning of the Constitution would have been. So I think those are all significant areas that we're likely to see development on.
Oh yeah, Professor.
Yeah, so there's one, I want to go back to Jimmy's comment because I thought it was very insightful. So what's the alternative to Smith? The alternative to Smith is basically Sherbert. Sherbert is the quintessential example of living constitutionalism. And if you, Justice Brennan wrote Sherbert. It's a perfect example of his approach to the Constitution. The original defender of the Sherbert approach is Michael McConnell, who clerked for Brennan. And if you read McConnell's defense of an originalist defense of Sherbert, it is a living constitutional defense. It's basically, look, the government has grown so much, and if we're going to protect rights now, you know, the same fundamental values that the founders protected religious liberty, but the state is so much larger now, so to protect religious liberty today, we need a much more aggressive, expansive, evolved notion of religious liberty. The foster care adoption case is a perfect example of that, right? The city of Philadelphia, the state didn't regulate these things back then. They do now, so we need a robust, a new type of protection of religious liberty, and then judges can step in and set aside popular majorities on an individual basis. That is living constitutionalism. Strict scrutiny is the manifestation of this. I mean, strict scrutiny is the implementation of living constitutionalism. And sooner or later, I mean, if you're originalist, you just got to deal with this. And so I don't think you can square the circle. I don't think you can be an originalist and overturn Smith. I mean, sorry, Beckett, but it's not the original meaning. The whole approach is contrary. And it's amazing to me to see originalists basically use the language of Justice Brennan. Now, I like those results, but one other point on this. Politically, I'm not sure it's even wise, because the real way we're going to protect religious liberty is we just have to face it. These non-discrimination laws apply to these categories that are hostile to traditional morality. There's no religious freedom if those laws pass. And judicial exemptions aren't going to work in the long run. I mean, I know this is basically to say, lawyers, you can't solve the problem, but all you need is the other side to say, there's a compelling state interest in applying these laws. We don't care if there's a burden on religious liberty. Exemptions are not a long-term solution, and we're fooling ourselves if we think they are. The only real solution is to not let these laws pass, and the problem is you leave the legislators off the hook. You say, the legislators say, well, I can pass this law that will be oppressive to my constituents because judges will give my constituents an exemption to the law. Well, that's how you get the laws passed. The laws then change the culture and no more religious liberty.
I think what that position misses is that for minority religions, that means there's basically no protection at all, because minority religions are not going to be able to in many cases, to get the laws changed. And unfortunately, even for conservative Christians, you know, in many places, that group isn't going to have sufficient political power to, you know, change the legislature's minds. And that's really why we have the Constitution, is because sometimes the legislature is going to enact things that are contrary to the Constitution because it's what 51% of the people want. And the reason we have the Constitution is to say, no, you know, we are going to protect free speech rights of Westboro Baptist Church, even if it's unpopular. We are going to protect foster parents like Sharon L. Fulton, even if the city of Philadelphia doesn't like the beliefs they have. So I think it's important to keep in mind that the idea of the Constitution is to, you know, in some ways to protect what the legislature, to protect against what the legislature and sometimes even the majority of the people would want to do. And then on the question of original public meeting, you know, I think there's lots of articles out there, and I would encourage you to look at them. But if Sherbert is not an original public meeting opinion, neither is Smith. Smith has nothing about the original public meaning of the free exercise clause. Again, it is all about the law of rules as a rule, and having a clear rule and not having to get into these exemptions. And it really disingenuously characterizes the court's prior precedent. So it's not even really a faithful application of the precedents to that point. Regardless of your approach to constitutional interpretation, it seems like what Justice Scalia was doing there was not something that was originalism. Again, that both of those opinions were not original public meaning opinions doesn't really answer the question of what the original public meaning is. And you know, we'd have to go back and look at that. And as I said, there's lots of stuff out there about that. I would just say briefly that, you know, giving the free exercise clause the meaning that Smith gives it really makes the free exercise clause fairly meaningless. It doesn't do a lot of work, and it seems puzzling that the founders would have included something as significant as the free exercise clause in the First Amendment if it was just supposed to do what Smith says.
Let's maybe move on to another clause in the First Amendment, and speaking of clear rules. I teach this class on the Establishment Clause at the University of Florida, and I always ask the students at the end, what's the clear rule after American Legion? Like, how do you go about analyzing Establishment Clause cases post-American Legion? So bringing it back to Justice Barrett, do we have any idea or indications if she will take a kind of a historical exception approach, somewhat like Justice Breyer? She's going to take more a legal coercion approach, like her former boss, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas. Any clues as to where she'll come out on the Establishment Clause?
You mind if I jump in on this, and then I'll
yes,
step
please.
Back while we do the other areas of law, which I know less well. If I had a chalkboard, I mean, I'm a faculty member, so I think this way. So on your right, before Amy got on the court, there's Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, and then Roberts sort of here, and then Breyer and Kagan here, and then Sotomayor and Ginsburg way over there on Establishment Clause issues. And so you've taken one of the most liberal members, strict separationist members, and then replaced her with Amy Barrett. And what's really interesting is you had four judges, right? Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. If Amy's over here, you don't need the chief. And that's really interesting. Because as far as I can tell, the Chief Justice doesn't like to overthrow anything, ever. And that's a real problem for Establishment Clause jurisprudence. Justice Thomas, as you undoubtedly know, likes, you know, would be willing to throw over anything he can that's not compatible with the original public meaning. It's conceivable you have five judges in the Establishment Clause area who would overthrow Everson versus Board of Education, the original Wallace separation case, Lemon versus Kurtzman, you know, basically the modern manifestation, the endorsement test. All of that could go if Justice Barrett would sign on an opinion with Justice Thomas and Chief Justice Roberts would let Justice Thomas write that opinion. Would the Chief Justice let those five write an opinion? Would he join them in an opinion? Would Justice Barrett join Justice Thomas, who's been calling for the overturning of everything in the Establishment Clause area from 1947? That's all on the table. In the way the Chief Justice still controls things by deciding who will write the opinion, but it could become the Thomas Court, and that would be a sea change in Establishment Clause jurisprudence.
Okay. Well. Please.
I'll just add one to relate this question to the last one. One interesting component of this is the Establishment Clause has been a mess for so long, and there's sort of been constant attempts to bury the ghoul, or whatever Justice Scalia famously called Lemon. So I think when you're looking at Smith, you know, and some other legal areas where the question is, Do we take sort of a Chief Justice approach and sort of refine the existing test to be able to deal with cases sort of on a one-off basis, or do we fix the test? I think you see the downside of the first approach in the Establishment Clause context, where the test has been wrong for a long time, and it seems like a majority of sitting justices at any particular time have recognized that, but haven't really taken the necessary step to clear it up. And that's fine for resolving cases on a one-off basis, but it leaves the lower courts in a pretty bad situation, as they don't know what the test is. And I think you saw some aspect of that in American Legion, as a couple Justice Thomas and I think Justice Gorsuch, didn't want to join the opinion for the court that was not finally resolving at least Lemon.
Okay, let's move on to our next substantive area where Justice Barrett's presence might change the court. So we know at least four justices are interested in taking a Second Amendment case. And after the New York State pistol and rifle case became moot last term, the court had held a lot of Second Amendment cases cases and then didn't grant cert on them. So I have kind of a two-part question, and I'd like to direct it to Amy first. So one, is the court more likely to take cert on a Second Amendment case now with Justice Barrett there? And then the second part is, what sort of standard do we think the court is going to articulate post-Heller? It seems like Justice Barrett, in a dissent when she was on the Seventh Circuit, suggested a history and tradition test as the appropriate one to apply, but I think a lot of the other courts of appeals have applied lack of a better word, intermediate scrutiny. So what can we expect going forward?
Yeah, so this is where I get very excited. I do the guns. So I think this, as Judge Mizell suggested, is one of those areas where Justice Barrett will have an immediate and significant impact just by her very presence. So it's not a secret that the court has been slow to follow up on Heller and McDonald in a meaningful way to sort of build out that bare bones framework. It's also not really a secret that one of the main reasons, if not the main reason for this, has been a lack of confidence in a fifth vote either way on this. And I think it's very clear now that it is the chief who sort of sits in that space of, well, we don't know which way he wants to go, and is the big question mark. Personally, I think it's more of a reluctance on his part to have another controversial 5-4 partisan looking opinion, and less so that he maybe doesn't have clear thoughts on Heller and McDonald, or is thinking about overturning them or limiting them in some way. So I think almost certainly with a Justice Barrett, I wouldn't be shocked if we see a Second Amendment case get taken up for later this term. I think certainly there will be plenty of opportunities for them to take one up next term, because there are a number of pretty significant cases in the pipeline. Now, why do I say that? And it goes back to her dissent in a Seventh Circuit case when she was on the Seventh Circuit in Cantor v. Barr. So Cantor v. Barr dealt with the issue of the federal prohibition on gun possession for nonviolent felons. So Cantor pled guilty to one count of federal mail fraud, something to the effect of he said that his shoe inserts were Medicare approved, they were not, and so he got false reimbursements for those. Now, under federal law, unless he basically gets a presidential pardon, he is banned for the rest of his life from possessing firearms. Now, that's an important issue. I don't think it's necessarily one that the court is going to take up next. I think the Supreme Court probably next takes up either a public carry case or an assault weapons case. But it's nonetheless important from what we learned about then Judge Barrett's way of viewing the Second Amendment and sort of her outline of Second Amendment jurisprudence. Because when you go through this, she ends up writing a dissent in this case. She's the lone dissenter that would have struck down this lawyer. Struck down this law, at least in this as-applied challenge to Cantor. So let's sort of go through this dissent. First of all, I think it's important to note this is like a 37-page dissent to a 20-page majority. I mean, she really goes in depth through the history of this. So she starts out with a conceptual point about approaching the constitutionality of gun laws generally. So for those of you who don't know, in the absence of the Supreme Court really stepping in and building out this framework, most lower courts have taken sort of a two-step approach to the Second Amendment. They've just sort of ad hoc created this. So they start off with the first question of whether the challenged law burdens something within the scope of the Second Amendment right. So is the conduct that we're talking about within the scope of the Second Amendment? And if it, clearly if it's not, that's the end of it. If it is within the scope of the Second Amendment right, then they move on to some form of intermediate scrutiny. Now, normally that has resulted in these laws being upheld. So Judge Barrett went through this, and she starts off with this, again, this conceptual approach, where she actually talks about how this is sort of a weird way of thinking about rights, that there are people like Cantor who are part of the people of the nation, the community of the nation, who all of a sudden fall outside the scope of an individual right, that Cantor is part of the people, and yet all of a sudden he again just falls outside the scope of that right, where we're talking about people and not conduct. So I think that's just an interesting way that she sort of reconceptualizes this and says, look, I think it's clear Cantor is part of the people, and the question is whether Wisconsin can disarm him anyway. So she kind of, even at the beginning, takes shots at that two-step framework. And then I think it's also important to go through and look at her analysis of whether this falls into Heller's list of longstanding and presumptively lawful prohibitions, because this is where it becomes very history-centered. The rest of this dissent almost reads like a deep dive in a law review article, where she really does this deep dive into founding era legislation, into the history of civil death for felons, into historical distinctions between civic rights and individual rights. And this is probably about 20, 25 pages of just going through the history in a very Scalia in Heller-esque way. So she concludes from the history, and I think rightfully so, that nothing in the Second Amendment's text, history, or tradition would lead her to conclude that felons lose their Second Amendment rights just because they're felons, and that instead what you see from the text, history, and tradition is that Congress can categorically exclude only those groups who it deems dangerous from possessing firearms. And so I think that's where you get into this this question of what does she think about scrutiny? Because again, Heller and McDonald don't specifically give a standard of scrutiny or a way of applying a standard of scrutiny to Second Amendment cases. On the one hand, the majority in those cases say that this balancing test approach isn't good enough. So it's not a balancing test approach. And then they talk about the text, history, and tradition a lot. And that has led some people to conclude that maybe the court doesn't want to apply a standard of scrutiny here. Maybe they do just want to go with this text, history, and tradition approach. And then others have suggested maybe it is a standard of scrutiny approach into which text, history, and tradition plays a role in shaping which standard of scrutiny you use or shaping strict scrutiny or intermediate scrutiny. But I think what we really see here is that she leans much more heavily toward that text, history, and tradition approach. Now, at the end, she does seem to go through, look, if we're going to get to this second step, if we're going to go into some form of intermediate scrutiny about whether it's substantially related to a government interest, she does do an analysis of the ban is both over-inclusive and under-inclusive as applied to Cantor. So it covers people like him who aren't dangerous just because they're felons, but then it also excludes people, such as violent misdemeanants, who are objectively more violent and prone to violence than him, but who aren't felons. And so she does sort of go through that analysis of, you know, the government hasn't been able to show this that it's substantially related to its interest. But at the end of the day, I think that focus on the text, history, and tradition really came to the forefront. But I also think that either way, it's a good sign for the Second Amendment as an individual right. Because I think even if she couches this under, you know, some sort of strict scrutiny, some sort of tiers of scrutiny, I think the way that you saw her approach the history and approach this reverence and respect for the Second Amendment, you know, at the end she paraphrases or quotes, I believe it is, it's from one of the dissents from denials of cert that I think it was a Thomas dissent, you know, that we've been treating the Second Amendment as a second class right, you know, and she references that in a way that again just shows the sort of respect and desire to build out this framework and to treat it as a full-fledged right that I think bodes well. Even though, you know, I don't see the court necessarily taking up the issue of felon rights next, I think it translates well into how she would approach, you know, an assault weapons case or a public carry case, because I think if you apply that same text, history, and tradition approach in whichever way, you know, I think that comes out well for Second Amendment advocates.
Thank you, Amy. I think maybe next, Jimmy, I want to ask you a couple questions about Article 3 standing and jurisdiction. So we've seen the court this year in particular has quite a few cases, including the one out of Georgia that asks whether nominal damages can suffice to allow for Article 3 standing. We also heard a lot of arguments in the healthcare case challenge again about whether the intersection between the severability creating standing or not. So the court is clearly interested in these. How will Justice Barrett's analysis play in?
Well, I do think the that nominal damages case is of a lot of interest to us. You know, the 11th Circuit's a bit of an outlier on that issue, so that's something we come across a lot just as government litigators. And I think listening to that argument, what was clear to me, well, just for background, for those who don't know what that case is about, the basic question is, can a bare claim for nominal damages be pursued? Is there Article III jurisdiction in that circumstance? Or are nominal damages really used, or historically were they used, more where somebody seeks compensatory damages, and then the judge finds that there was a constitutional violation, but the person can't prove damages, and so they sort of enter an award of nominal damages on the back end? But what happens if you just, at the very beginning, say, all I want are nominal damages? So the way I sort of read the justices is there were two competing concerns, and they were having a really hard time figuring out how to reconcile them. Because I think a lot of the justices thought that there was a lot of historical evidence for this theory of jurisdiction, but simultaneously, they were trying to understand why this isn't a complete end run around the mootness doctrine. Why every time, you know, the government does something wrong and then goes, oops, why you can't just bring a nominal damages claim and litigate the constitutionality of that. And that's actually a very big deal. I mean, if any of you have ever counseled a client in the private sector, imagine you tell your client, you know, if you pay a $100,000 settlement, they won't pursue damages against you anymore, but we are still going to have to litigate this case. I mean, your client would never settle. And so government actors are no different. You have very well-intentioned people who are often not lawyers. They're genuinely trying to do what they think is best for their constituents. And sometimes you have to counsel them and say, you know, there might be some issues with this. There's some litigation risk. And I think that's something that should be rewarded. A good system is one where the government lawyers counsel the policymakers. They take that seriously, and they change the policy. Whatever rule the justices craft, I think what's important to me personally is just that they do not create sort of a complete end run around the mootness doctrine, because I think the practical effect of that is that it will be harder to talk policymakers into doing things like this. And of course, that's what we want. And that's actually in that case. What happened in that case was that Georgia basically backed down and changed their policy. And so, you know, that seems virtuous to me, and that seems like a good thing. And so my hope is just that can continue to be rewarded.
I think Christopher has a response. He's eager to give. I'm sure.
Can I just
ask
to be
one
clear,
question too about this? If Georgia had offered the nominal damages amount, would that have mooted the case? I don't know. Go ahead, Christopher.
That's a good question, Judge Mizell. But I'm not going to talk about that. What Jimmy said was a good system is, you know, maybe sometimes a good system, but often not a good system. I mean, in this very case, the plaintiff was injured. He didn't get to exercise his free speech rights. You know, the fact that he couldn't put a dollar amount on that doesn't obviously suggest that the courts shouldn't be able to, you know, adjudicate and affirm the fact that he was injured. And while, again, sometimes it might be a good system for government policymakers to think through their policies and change them when they're necessary, look at what's happened with COVID. I mean, we all know what's going on. When a case starts to go up to the Supreme Court, California changes its policy, New York changes its policy, and then what do they say? The case is moot. New York State and Rifle, what happens? The state says, oh, we're going to pass a new policy, and just for good measure, we're going to have the state pass a law saying we can't have the old law, and then we can say it's moot so that we don't have legal rights adjudicated properly in the courts. So, you know, I just don't want, you know, anyone to have the impression that we're always talking about virtuous policymakers just doing what they think is right, as opposed to agency employees trying to avoid courts vindicating people's constitutional rights.
If I could ask another follow-up question for the panel on standing, do we have any indication of whether Justice Barrett would be interested in the position that Justice Gorsuch articulated in American Legion about revisiting the offender status for Establishment Clause cases, giving rise to standing and it, as an outlier in the court's jurisprudence? I didn't know, Professor, if you had any thoughts on that.
I don't know. I have had the thought that the Chief Justice might try to counteract the Justice Thomas major revision by making it harder to get standing to sue. And I don't know where Justice Barrett will come down on that. If there are two courses of action that you could see possible and which one Justice Barrett would take, I just don't know.
I was just going to add, I see that jurisdictional doctrine, the offended observer, as a byproduct of the court's view of the merits of the Establishment Clause. Yeah. Of course, Gorsuch and Thomas think you need coercion to violate the Establishment Clause. So being an offended observer is not a violation of the Establishment Clause on the merits. And so I would think that if Justice Barrett, maybe there are justices who are willing to say that a violation of the Establishment Clause is broader, but you can't get standing if you're an offended observer, but then it's hard to imagine how many plaintiffs will be able to create standing in those cases. So to me, it's very much wrapped up with whether Justice Barrett will share the coercion view on the merits.
So another big topic that the court has addressed a lot in recent terms is administrative law. We saw them discuss our deference in Kaiser and the census litigation. DACA, administrative law has had certainly a key role in the court's cases recently. Do we have any indication of where Justice Barrett is on, you know, Chevron or our, both doctrines that her former boss endorsed, at least at one point?
I know.
Yeah, well, I think the interesting thing here is, you know, and if someone else has a different view, you know, feel free. I don't know that there's a lot of indication from her time on the Seventh Circuit. Administrative law wasn't really a thing that seemed to come up a lot for her in the Seventh Circuit. Certainly much different from what we saw with, say, Judge Kavanaugh when he was judge on the D.C. Circuit, where you had admin law stuff come up all the time. I can't recall if she had any law review articles on this, because I know as a professor, that was sort of her thing. She was more civil procedure, constitutional law, and so she has this very developed academic literature on con law and her jurisprudential approach to the Constitution. But I think admin law specifically, there seemed to me to be sort of this blank space. Now, how that might be filled in by those who know her well, you know, who knows, you know, certainly as an originalist, you can probably draw some conclusions about, you know, how she thinks about it. But it really is just a bigger blank space than we see in other sort of meatier parts of, you know, First Amendment jurisprudence, criminal law, Second Amendment, individual rights, those types of things.
I also think this is an area where it'll very much be the Barrett Court and pretty much all the decisions you just mentioned, Judge Mizell, that it was 5-4 with the Chief Justice joining the more liberal members of the court. And you know, that was obviously a theme of last term's decision when the Chief Justice was in the majority in, I think, 97% of the term's cases, all but two. So I think you will see perhaps a different approach this term, and given that she is now sort of the potential fifth vote on many of these administrative law issues, I predict that the admin area will be one area where you will see her influence pretty heavily. I mean, there's just not many original public meaning defenses of things like Auer and Chevron, and so to the extent you know, she's going to adhere to that approach to interpretation. I think the only question is really her views on stare decisis and how that's going to affect these areas.
So that actually segues nicely into my next question, which do we have a good sense of how she's going to view stare decisis? She wrote, she was very prolific as an academic on that topic. Do we see more litigants pressing to overrule cases as a result of her being on the court?
She has an article just a few years old on originalism and stare decisis, and I can't remember off the top of my head where it's published. And I went back to look at that since her nomination and confirmation. What's interesting is she doesn't take the Justice Thomas route. So, and she defends Justice Scalia's faint-hearted originalism, but it's an odd sort of defense because she says, well, Justice Scalia said he's a faint-hearted originalist, but in practice, the conflict isn't as significant as Justice Scalia made it out to be. It's an impressive article and very careful, very thoughtful, but she doesn't really tip her hand on what she will do as a justice. And I during the panel, I've been thinking here, Amy's relatively young. I think her birthday was, it's either today or yesterday, and you know, she's 48 or 49. You're in your late 40s and you're on the Supreme Court. You probably start to think about yourself differently on, you know, like, what is my, you know, there's one thing to have a judicial philosophy. It's another thing to have a judicial philosophy and write Supreme Court opinions. I think she's probably hasn't found her voice yet. You know, it's just by her character is not someone who would be like Justice Thomas, all overthrow everything if it's against original meaning. That's just not her. She's a very moderate person. On the other hand, I don't know, maybe if you're sitting around with Justice Thomas a lot and you respect him so much, maybe, you know, you realize, wow, I'm going to be doing this for 20, 30 years, and that is what the country needs, and that's my obligation. So I just think it's very hard to tell, and partly probably because she hasn't developed her constitutional voice.
You bring up one question, in moving into our last kind of segment, her style and tone. Well, should we expect to see a lot of separate writings like Justice Thomas, or you seem to indicate that you think she maybe won't be as prolific in that regard?
I would just say I it would be. You know, this will be a question will be interesting to talk about 5 years from now, you know, or give her some time, and then we'll know maybe.
Does anyone have any thoughts on her style of questioning? She certainly has a more straightforward, less commentary style, at least, and I don't know if that's in part because of the virtual organization of OAs that encourages that.
I'll jump in on her style and tone here. And I think this also goes back a little bit more to her writing style as well, because I think they're very much tied together. So what I've seen both in her writing, I mean, granted she has not authored an opinion as a Supreme Court justice yet, but she had quite a few of them as a Seventh Circuit judge. She's written a number of law review articles. And you know, we've now seen oral argument in probably 24 cases. She is very straightforward. She doesn't pontificate a whole lot either in her writing or in her oral arguments. She doesn't, and again, she is still young and developing her voice. She doesn't have sort of the sharp elbows of Scalia. She doesn't have necessarily that same flair, if you will. But her writing and questioning style is very concise and very thorough. With her writing, she takes her time, as I suggested in Cantor v. Barr, to go through and really develop that history and do her due diligence and wade into the complications of things, and instead of just sort of waving a magic wand over them and here's a paragraph about how I got from A to B to C. She'll go, Here's A, here's B, here's C, and really develop those out. And then in terms of her oral argument style in particular, again, as I'm sure you're all aware, the Supreme Court has, because of COVID reasons, taken on a very different nature. It's got Justice Thomas talking and asking questions, which personally I think is great. But it is very conducive to, each justice has their timeline to ask a certain set of questions. And of course, being the least senior justice, Justice Barrett is sort of the last person, which I think certainly probably has some sort of impact on which questions she asks, because a lot of questions are getting asked before, so it's a lot of follow-up questions, a lot of listening and referencing questions that other justices have asked. But one thing I think she has taken after Justice Thomas in particular with is asking not just concise questions, but then allowing the advocates to actually answer them. It's not just a lack of pontificating, it's, I think, a willingness to actually hear out the advocates and let the advocates advocate, which even with the limited timeframes and the chunked questioning system that the court is using, that hasn't always been the case with some of the other justices, who will spend the entire 4 or 5 minutes sort of asking the long-winded question, and then it's like, I'm sorry, counsel, you have 10 seconds to answer that 3 minute and 57 second question that I asked. So that has been nice to see, and I think all of that just sort of fits into, again, her personality of being more laid back, not having those sharp elbows, being more personable.
Well, I guess I have one final question, and then we'll open it up for the audience. Any guesses as to her first opinion assignment? She's joined a few per curiams, but she hasn't authored her first opinion. Okay.
I looked at the November sitting in case you asked this question. There's a fascinating FOIA case called Fish and Wildlife Services versus Sierra Club. I'll go with that.
I'm going to agree with Chris for the first time today. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know.
Okay, well, that, yeah. I thought that was a fun question. Maybe not as fun for everyone. Are there any questions from the audience? We certainly would want to hear what you're most interested in about Justice Barrett. And if no one has any questions, I'm going to ask my law clerks to come up with some, since they're all here. So,
While we're waiting for our first questioner to come up, I will say I, for one, am disappointed that after all of the hubbub and all of the advertisements by some, I'm a bit disappointed that she hasn't yet unilaterally made the nation, you know, protectorate of the papal state or you know, banned birth control. So I think we still have yet to see her fully develop in that regard.
Yes, sir.
Good morning. I'm Michael Isaac from Tampa, Florida. I was wondering to get your opinion, now that the Senate is set to hold a trial in the next couple of weeks, to get your opinion on the constitutional authority to go forward with that trial now that President Trump is no longer in office. It seems to me the implications, if you read Federalist 65 or even Anti-Federalist 66 or 72, that one of the prerequisites is that the president still be in office. I was also wondering, since the Senate has apparently voted to have jurisdiction, is it a viable theory to seek prohibition in the federal courts, or would that violate the separation of powers?
On the constitutionality of the trial and removing, or not removing, convicting a ex-president, I'm not sure. My initial sort of the thinking of the thing is impeachment and removal, the end is removal. And if you can't remove, then if the end's not there, it doesn't make sense. But then lots of people I respect, Keith Whittington and the Wall Street Journal and others, have pushed back on that. So let me just use this as an advertisement. I direct Notre Dame's program in constitutional studies. And on Wednesday, we're having a panel on this very question. John Yoo will be on the panel. And then on the other side, a very famous, very ideologically motivated presidency scholar, Jeffrey Toulis, wrote a book called The Rhetorical Presidency, and then a presidency scholar. These are political scientists, Jeffrey Toulis and Ben Kleinerman. So it's going to be Zoomed live, and you know, John's a good friend and is very thoughtful on these things, and I don't know. So you can find out with me on Wednesday what John has to say about these things.
Yeah, I would also suggest that my colleague Paul Larkin has just recently written on this issue, and you know, this is the interesting thing about this is you see people really getting into these textual arguments, which is just fascinating. You know, so on the one hand, you have the argument from sort of the original English common law development of this, you know, pointing to the Warren Hastings trial and how that went on for, you know, 7 years or something to that effect after he had been removed from office. You know, so you have some of those arguments. You have the argument of the clause that, you know, that the Senate shall have the power to try all impeachments, that he has been impeached while he was in office. But then you also then have other people who will make, as my colleague Paul Larkin does, the textualist argument that in other clauses it talks about, you know, the removal power and seems to suggest that, you know, in order to actually try and convict and remove him, he must be president. And as of now, he is not president. He is a private citizen. So, thank you for letting us know about that event. It seems to me that if there is a majority consensus, it may seem to be that he can be tried after leaving office, but I don't know that there's a hard and fast originalist or textualist answer to that, or in terms of, you know, what a hypothetical Justice Barrett might do in that hypothetical case where that comes before, who knows.
I agree with the others that there are, you know, substantial arguments on both sides. I know Professor Yoo has said the Senate, you know, doesn't have basically jurisdiction over a former officer. I know Michael McConnell has said that it does. McConnell's position is supported by some early practice and practice in the states at the time of the founding, which, as Amy said, especially where the text doesn't seem to clearly resolve the issue, you know, the courts often find persuasive that sort of evidence of his original public meaning. I think it's a tough question. I think your second question is also difficult. You know, obviously what comes to mind is the political question doctrine, or given that that doctrine maybe has fallen out of favor a little bit, you know, focusing on the constitutional text, which says that the Senate has the sole power to try impeachment, implying that, you know, as in other cases where the court has used the political question doctrine, it's up to the Senate to decide the question of jurisdiction. So I think it's probably likely that that's the direction the court would go if a challenge was brought in court, but I don't think it's obvious.
Thank you.
Oh, I look like I've coerced a law clerk into asking a question. Thank you, Diego.
I guess a couple areas maybe to see where Justice Barrett might come out are criminal justice and qualified immunity, especially criminal justice with respect to Fourth Amendment, like Carpenter, search and seizure issues. And the other one, qualified immunity, you know, pretty hot topic right now. So any indications where she might go, or, you know, where are Justices Thomas and Gorsuch and Alito if she tends to go with them? Thank you.
So when I look at kind of the last decade of the U.S. Supreme Court's Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, one of the big themes I see is trying to figure out how to take, you know, sort of modern technologies and things that the founders never would have thought about, and to figure out how to apply the Fourth Amendment in that context. And I think what you see is sort of a, you know, kind of, you had Justice Scalia on one side arguing for sort of 18th century trespass law, and then you had Justice Alito on the other side saying we should just use the Katz test, reasonable expectation of privacy. So I think, you know, the nature of the coalitions and the fact that this doesn't sort of fall along traditional ideological lines tells me that, you know, well-meaning originalists are really having a hard time figuring out how to do this, and how to do it, you know, taking the original meaning but applying it to situations that the founders never would have thought of. So I think it's very hard to predict how Justice Barrett will come out on that, because, you know, the only thing I think I know about her is that she's a well-meaning originalist, and you have well-meaning originalists doing so many different things in this area. So sorry for the non-answer, but that's kind of my take on it.
Yeah, and I think too, especially in terms of the Section 1983 stuff, I mean, what we do know about her is from when she was a Seventh Circuit judge, you know, in applying Supreme Court precedent, which is a very different role than necessarily answering that question of whether that precedent on Section 1983 and qualified immunity is correct. So I can think of at least a couple of cases off the top of my head where she did, or was at least part of a panel that found there was qualified immunity that did apply in those cases. You know, but again, that's very different than her as a Supreme Court justice addressing, you know, whether or not that precedent is valid or needs to be reevaluated. So it's just very hard given those different positionings.
On the qualified immunity question, I think it's also important to note that it's not obvious that she would be a fifth vote for getting rid of something like qualified immunity, and that I'm not sure there are four others. And so, you know, I guess it's possible there could be some cross-court alliances on that particular question, but I would say that one's, to me, less likely to see a big change than some of the other areas we've talked about, like the religion clauses.
Hi, I'm Hiram Sasser. I got a question. Six judges on the Fifth Circuit recently signed onto a footnote that calls Employment Division versus Smith the Dred Scott of the First Amendment. Does anybody on the panel have any reaction to that? And do you feel like there's kind of a growing momentum to overturn Employment Division versus Smith, especially given, I mean, six judges on the Fifth Circuit willing to make a statement of that sort?
So one of the questions I want to ask Chris, really the whole panel, but especially Chris, you know, what does the current political situation do to the justices? You know, the fact that the first weeks of the Biden administration, he's gone out, you know, very hard on the Equity Act and transgender rights. If you read, on the plane on the way down, I read the transcript, reread the transcript of Fulton, and I encourage you all to read it. It's absolutely fascinating. Just the law is fascinating, but just as a commentary of people trying to think through our present political moment. And at one point, Justice Alito basically says to the Philadelphia lawyers, look, this case is basically the city of Philadelphia trying to beat the Catholic Church down and say, you are not a legitimate institution in civil society. I'm paraphrasing, he didn't exactly say that, but that's the point. Isn't that really what this is about? The Catholic Church either must change, or the Catholic Church must exit the public square being anywhere government touches, or anywhere government funds touch. And what does that do to Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer, right? Okay, there's this huge victory for gay rights in Obergefell. Is it possible now, given that Biden has won, that the Democrats control the Senate, that you get Justice Kagan or maybe Breyer writing an opinion that overturns Smith that's not an originalist decision, and you get the originalist judges, justices sort of signing on to it? That seems more possible now in a judges, the court trying to moderate our politics. This is all speculation. I have no idea if this will happen. But it seems to me the situation is different than it was in October, or even when the case was heard in November. And I wonder, like, Breyer has long called for overturning Smith. I could see him, you know, you could even maybe get a 8-1 or 7-2 case, maybe not this case, but maybe a 7-2 opinion overturning Smith on very sort of moderate, in light of Sherbert, Smith hasn't proved to be workable. It's not really an originalist opinion. Maybe you have some originalist concurrences. That would reflect, or at least piggyback on, the signing on the footnote.
I think what's also interesting is to trace over time, really starting especially with RFRA, which was agreed to by huge majorities in Congress, signed into law by President Clinton, took a very religious liberty protective approach, obviously, to sort of the modern day criticisms of RFRA, which tend to come from the left, lots of hostility to state level RFRAs. So I do think there are still some political sort of opposition to the expansion of religious liberties, especially coming from that angle. So it's hard to tell. Obviously, the Fifth Circuit statement is relatively strong, but I think the professor is right that even in Fulton, Justice Breyer said it was bothering him a lot that no family had ever been turned away by the agency. Justice Kagan said, I don't think you can get out of Smith and Lukumi that easily. If there's an exception, then it's not neutral and generally applicable. The Justice Alito quote that professor was saying was, if we are honest about what's really going on here, it's not about ensuring that same-sex couples in Philadelphia have the opportunity to be foster parents. It's the fact that the city can't stand the message that Catholic Social Services is sending by continuing to adhere to the old-fashioned view about marriage. So I do think you see some cross-court concerns about how to deal with the case going forward, but it is complicated by both the sort of hostility toward RFRA-type protections in some quarters, as well as the new administration and how that will play out with some of the orders the professor talked about.
I think one thing we should expect in the short term is just a much more bolstered general applicability rule. And I think a lot of the justices have alluded to this, that part of the problem with Smith is that too many laws are considered of general applicability. And I think what we should expect to see coming from the court is that if you get any exception for anybody, then you have to give religion the same exception, or really if you're giving exceptions, you have to give religious exceptions. So I think one thing that will be interesting to see is if we get that kind of clarification from the court, do people still feel the same way about Smith? Is that sort of Smith plus doing enough to protect religious liberty, or is that still not enough? So that's what I expect in the short term. I don't try to predict these things because I'm almost always wrong, but that is what I expect in the short term.
That's interesting, Jimmy, because in the Diocese of Brooklyn case, Justice Kavanaugh basically lays that out mm-hmm. as kind of his view of Smith, right? Mm-hmm. If you have any comparator that's treated better than the religious group, that's who you have to measure mm-hmm. the person against. Whereas I think Justice Sotomayor was taking kind of the opposite view. Like, it's the, if anyone's treated worse than you, that's who you can measure with. Yeah.
And that's a really important question to figure out what the proper comparators are, because we've seen it in the COVID cases. The government will come in and say, well, here are the relevant comparators. And the question is, do courts say, oh, well, they say casinos are different, so they must be different? Or does the court say, well, what's the government interest you are asserting? And then we are going to figure out the relevant comparators from that interest. So is the focus on the government interest that's being asserted, or is it just if the government says, well, this is different, you know, how much deference and leeway does the government have?
Yeah, I think like in the New York case, the state had said, well, we have movie theaters closed, so they're similar to houses of worship. But the opposite argument was, you know, stores and bike shops and other kind of general businesses are still open without restrictions. Well, I think we're, unless there's any other urgent questions, can we all give a big thank you to our panelists?